8 Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin's milk production hit an all-time high last year, but thousands of farms have disappeared in the last decade. We'll hear from a farmer about how state policy is changing the dairy industry. First, the Trump administration announced last night that it would not, for the time being at least, work to roll back the Obama-era immigration policy known as the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA. The policy prevented the deportation of undocumented people who were brought into the country illegally as children. The move marks a bit of a reversal for President Trump, who campaigned with a promise that he would make it a goal to deport tens of thousands of undocumented people. However, while DACA is still in place, an Obama-era memo allowing for the protection of the parents of children under the program has been eliminated. Daniel Costa joins us now for more on this. He is a director of immigration law and policy research at the Economic Policy Institute. Daniel, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, and thanks for having me on.
Well, can you talk about who is affected by this decision? First of all, the part that handles DACA, the part with children. How many people are affected?
We're talking about 750,000 people who have joined and or renewed since 2012 when the policy was announced by President Obama.
And why do you think the Trump administration has, at least for the time being, decided to keep that in place?
It's really hard to say. The Trump administration does have a lot of authority in this sphere. They said they were going to rescind it, but I'm pleasantly surprised that they haven't. But it's tough to know why they did it. Either they haven't gotten around to figuring out a way that they want to get rid of it, or maybe they think that there's more of a political cost than a political benefit to getting rid of it. But the key thing to remember is that for now the people who came to this country as children brought by undocumented parents at least will have some protection and can keep working and not worry about getting deported just yet.
Can you look back in the Obama administration and talk about the motivation for this policy from the Obama White House?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of frustration from the administration that Congress couldn't get its act together and pass comprehensive immigration reform that would have created a permanent solution for not just this subset of unauthorized immigrants, but for the whole unauthorized immigrant population. And so the government doesn't have a presidential administration, I should say, doesn't have authority to give someone a new form of legal status, but what they can do is give them deferred action, which is essentially a promise not to deport someone for the time being. That's all that DACA really is. It's the government saying, we promise not to deport you for right now. And when you make that promise to not deport someone under applicable laws and regulation, the government actually has the authority to give that person a work permit while they have that deferred action status. And I think that was just one solution to target and help this vulnerable and population that I think there was a lot of public support for helping.
What do you see as the impact of DACA from its inception until now?
Well, I mean, the impact is, for the people who have gotten DACA themselves, has been really, really great. I mean, we know from a recent study and survey done by the Center for American Progress that the people who have DACA, most of them, the vast majority are working, the vast majority are actually bilingual, and the vast majority, on average, they increased the wages that they were earning by about 42%, each one of them. And so that really shows the value of having a work permit, which means that they suddenly, all of these people who got DACA who were mostly working suddenly had access to labor and employment law rights, and before they didn't have that. And so if you got rid of DACA, you'd suddenly have 750,000 workers who don't have access to labor rights, which would not be good for their wages and would not be good for the wages and working conditions of people who work alongside them.
We're talking about U.S. immigration policy with Daniel Costa from the Economic Policy Institute. A couple announcements in effect from the Trump administration. DACA, the non-deportation executive decision that affects children who are brought into the country undocumented, illegally, can stay at least for the time being. But let's look at the other part of this now, the DAPA, the part that affects the parents of these children. Well, what did we see there?
Right, so that was the Obama administration in 2014 tried to expand on DACA and try to target another large group of unauthorized immigrants, which would have been about 4 or 5 million people who had U.S. citizen children or children who were who were lawful permanent residents. And before that ever got to be implemented, it got stuck in the courts. And the Obama administration was trying to litigate this through the court and the Supreme Court and the federal courts, but the administration was over before that actually got resolved. And so now the Trump administration was in a position where they had to make a decision on it. Either they could continue going to court to try to fight to have DAPA come into effect, but they simply decided that they weren't going to litigate it and try to defend it, and just rescinded the policy so that it would just never come into effect and just doesn't exist anymore.
So that means this ongoing court battle, and this has been going on for a while, it's just over now, is that right?
Yeah, essentially, yes. The Trump administration is saying they're not going to litigate it anymore, and that they'll just get rid of the policy, and which renders the issue moot in terms of the court.
And now this, as you mentioned, this policy was never actually implemented. About how many people would we be talking about who would have been affected by it?
That's correct. It would have been about 4 to 5 million people we were talking about. And it also had some parts of it that would have expanded on DACA. So DACA stays in place, but DAPA, as part of it, not only had this new deferred action for 4 to 5 million unauthorized immigrants who were parents of citizens, but it also would have expanded DACA. It would have changed the rules so that more people would have been applicable for it, and it would have made 3-year permits instead of 2-year permits. And that expansion of DACA is also gone and off the table. The original DACA from 2012 stays in place, but everything that was proposed in 2014 under DAPA just will never happen.
Big picture on immigration enforcement, on a practical level, what have we seen change from the Obama administration to the Trump administration when it comes to who's being detained, who's being deported?
Well, the biggest change, I think, the most notable thing, was the executive order on interior immigration enforcement, which was put out by the Trump administration a couple of months ago. And it essentially got rid of the old priorities for deportation, which the Obama administration had in place, which really targeted people with criminal records or who were criminals or who had been deported before or who were recent arrivals. And the Trump administration's new priorities are essentially a big list that encompasses almost anyone who is undocumented, even people who don't have a criminal record. It even includes people who may have committed an act that could hypothetically lead to a criminal charge, but never led to a criminal charge. So all of those people now are priorities for deportation. And we've also seen some changes in policies, like the Trump administration going to courthouses and waiting for immigrants who are on trial or who are suing their employer or who are in a criminal case where they've been the victim of a crime, and waiting for people coming outside of there. And that's created a backlash. So, you know, there's been statements from the Chief Justice of California, who came out and said that this is terrible and it's really hindering access to justice for people who have been victims. And you know, some of these little policy shifts have really just led to more people being in fear of being deported and a lot of people being deported. And the Trump administration is also making what's called collateral arrests. So if they go and target someone for deportation and there's someone around them who, even if they're non-criminal, don't have immigration status, then they've been subject to deportation as well. And Trump has even deported some people with DACA, just claiming that they've done something that violates their status.
I want to go back to a point you mentioned earlier. This is all coming from either policies set by the Obama White House or the Trump White House in the absence of legislation from Congress to clarify a lot of these issues. Is there anything going on in Congress to work toward what people have been trying to work for a long time, some kind of comprehensive restatement of immigration policy?
Not really. I mean, the Democrats in Congress certainly would like to pass some sort of a comprehensive immigration reform bill, and there is a group of Republicans who would like to see the same. But I do think that the Republican Party is very much split between the sort of establishment business Republicans and the Tea Party / Trump supporting Republicans in terms of what they want. I think one group wants a legalization and large guest worker programs to have new migrant workers. And the other wing of the party really just wants more enforcement, no legalization, and more deportations. And so it's really going to be up to the Republican Party to see what they can sort out and what sort of solutions they can propose that maybe other people can get on board with. But it doesn't appear that President Trump would support some sort of broad legalization of the undocumented population. So for the time being, I don't think there's going to be much action on that in Congress. You'll probably see smaller, targeted bills that have to do with with more guest workers in agriculture or more high-tech guest workers. But that's probably the most that you'll see. And even those are going to be contentious because of the split in the Republican Party.
Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Daniel Costa, Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. He joined us today to talk about the Trump administration's decision to wait on overturning protections extended to young, undocumented people who were brought into the country illegally as children. Right now, Wisconsin produced over 30 billion pounds of milk in 2016, reaching a goal that Governor Walker set for the year 2020. However, the number of dairy farms has dropped dramatically in recent years as large concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, have grown. Our next guest says that by pushing policies that encourage overproduction of milk and resist environmental regulation, the legislature and state agencies are favoring the biggest operators in the dairy industry and are leaving smaller farms behind. Jim Goodman is with us now. He is a dairy farmer in Waniwok, Wisconsin, and author of a recent opinion piece in the Capital Times encouraging supply management and environmental protection. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Jim, the governor had set that policy, that goal of increasing dairy production. We've succeeded, but you see that as bad news for many dairy farmers in the state. Why is that?
Well, I think the main thing that anybody, whether they're a farmer or a teacher or whatever job they have, they need to be profitable. They need to have enough money to make a decent living. And obviously, with the decrease in dairy prices due to the increase in supplies, dairy farmers are not doing so well, and most would agree that they're probably losing quite a lot of money.
And what are you seeing as far as trends in terms of the size of operations? Are you seeing a lot of smaller farming operations going out of business?
Well, that's the way I understand it. The field man from our dairy co-op was here this morning, and he said he's got about four small farms right in my area that are just going to give it up because it's not profitable enough for them to keep it up any longer. And we know that many farms are getting larger expanding, the individual farms are expanding, our dairies are coming in and starting up, and most of them are planning on being quite large because it's really difficult to make it as a small farmer anymore.
And you say it's not just the economy making bigger farms more possible. You write that the state government has been tipping the scales in favor of the bigger operations. How so?
Well, that's the way it seems to me. Several years ago, as I mentioned in the article, they made grants available for farmers to modernize or expand. And at the time, I needed to make some improvements on my milking system. I only milk 45 cows, and I got in touch with, I believe, DATCAP was handling the grant administration, and they explained to me, well, it's really not for that type of situation. That we really had planned this more for farmers to hire consultants to better enable them to do a good job of expanding and planning out their operations. So, you know, that kind of clued me in that they really wanted farmers to get bigger, not to improve the small facilities that were already existing in the state. So that was one example, and I think Governor Walker's statement several years ago that Wisconsin was open for business and the trends of the DNR to not enforce the regulations as well as they should on these big farms that really have a lot of manure to get rid of. I think we can look at places like Huamani County where there's a huge number of CAFOs that have there's more cows than people in that county, and the soil just in that part of the state just really isn't meant to support that many animals in such a small area, and we see a lot of well contamination problems. So it just appears that the trend is to push for bigger farms and more efficiency, as they would say.
What are we seeing with milk prices over the last few years?
Well, 2014 was a good year for dairy farmers. I think conventional milk prices were up over $20, $21 a hundred, and now they're back down in that, I'm guessing, probably around $15 to $16 a hundred. And, you know, the USDA every month, every year, calculates cost of production figures. And right now, for Wisconsin, they're estimating the cost of production is almost $27 a hundred. So if a farmer's only getting $15 to $16, that means he's losing, you know, somewhere between $8 to $10, depending on the operation, depending on if he has to buy feed or his labor situation. So that's kind of hard to do, to lose money on every day you get up and go to the barn to milk cows.
And we saw this story earlier this year. A Canadian company said, because of complicated trade reasons, it wasn't going to be buying milk from 75 Wisconsin dairy farmers. You were critical of the state government's response to that. Where do you think they went wrong?
Yeah, and it wasn't just the state government. I think it was the federal government too. They were trying to blame Canada for not buying this milk product from the United States. And what Canada had actually done and had been planning on doing for several years was creating their own class of that ultra-filtered milk so Canadian farmers could produce the milk to be used in Canada. And once they got that market and that price system established, they were buying Canadian milk and they no longer needed the milk from the United States. And the United States cried foul. Well, it wasn't really Canada's fault. We produced too much milk, and we can't expect the world to take it off our hands and pay us a good price for it.
And you weren't part of that story, but you had seen a vendor, somebody who's buying your milk, not need your milk anymore for a while. How did your experience compare to farmers who'd been selling to that Canadian company?
Well, our situation was a little bit different. We're an organic producer, and the organic market is really saturated with milk right now, too, and the co-op we were selling to lost a market it had due to a lot of organic milk that's being produced in the western United States that a lot of people would say is not really meeting all the organic standards. But, there's so much organic milk produced that the prices went down, and a lot of markets changed because they could get large volumes of cheaper organic milk that we were told we had about a month and a half to find a new market, and I was lucky enough to do that. I'm thinking some of the other producers in that situation probably had to sell their milk in the conventional market, which would be about a 50% price cut.
Talking to Jim Goodman, he's a dairy farmer in Waniwok. He wrote a piece in the Capital Times saying the state is favoring large-scale dairy operations at the expense of smaller dairy farms. And, Jim, let's talk about what you might like to see from the state when it comes to dairy policy. What do you think would be a better idea?
Well, I don't think there's much question that the small rural communities in Wisconsin have been suffering due to businesses closing, you know, not just Main Street businesses, but the farms that surround those communities. And I think those farms were the ones that supported local business. So I just have never really understood why they were willing to let small farms go out of business when the economic consequences for the rural area were so dire. I think that we need to be, and I've thought this for 20 or 30 years, that we need to be looking at some sort of supply management system like Canada has, where farm prices are supportive of the farmer, consumers have adequate milk supplies, and there's no surplus of milk that they have to be trying to get rid of and flooding the market and cutting farm prices. And in most cases, the prices Canadian consumers paid for milk in the store was equal to or lower than what Americans were paying for their milk, while dairy farm prices were much higher than what we were getting and doing a good job of supporting Canadian dairy farmers.
On the environmental side, what would you like to see the state change when it comes to dairy farms?
Well, I think I quoted former DNR Secretary George Meyer in my piece, and you know he said that the standards are there, the rules that protect groundwater and too much manure spreading are there. It's just that they need to be enforced. You know, we've got plenty of rules, we've got plenty of things in place, and these big dairies, and again, I'll go back to Kewaunee County, have to have a lot of water for all these cattle, and they use it to flush the manure out of their barns. And the DNR never considers the cumulative impact of all those wells. They give permits based on one well at a time, and the cumulative draw keeps getting worse and worse and drawing the water out of the groundwater system. And if that were limited, I think that it might make a big difference on how large these farms can get, especially in areas like Kewaunee County where there's such a huge number of cattle.
Jim, your piece focused mostly on the economics and environmental impact of dairy farming, but how about smaller dairy farms as a way of life? I think when people think of Wisconsin, they picture that small-scale dairy farmer as, you know, part of the community, an anchor of the community in some ways. Is that something that worries you as we see you know, thousands of dairy farms going out of business over the course of a decade or two.
Well, yeah, and like I said, I'm an organic dairy farmer, so I'm in a little bit different market, and we've usually had a little bit higher price, but I really hate to see my neighbors going out of business. I don't like to see anybody working and not making a decent living and a profit. And I think that if the state and the big dairy processors really think that large farms are such a great way of farming, when they sell their milk in the store, they should have a picture of those farms and not a little red barn and some cows and chickens running around, because in reality, that's not the picture of farming in Wisconsin, but that's what they want it to look like, because they know that's what people want to buy and that's what sells.
We hear sometimes on the show, Jim, about a generational change. Farmers aging, not a next generation to take over. I mean, how hard would it be for someone to decide, hey, I want to be a dairy farmer and to start from ground zero?
Well, it would be almost impossible. Land prices are high enough that in order to buy land without some kind of help from a family or a farmer that wants to help someone get started, it really would be pretty much cost prohibitive, especially if you want to grow your own feed. Possibly in a situation on a farm like mine where it's smaller, we're bringing a young couple in to eventually take over the farm and helping them out economically. That is probably, as I see it, and many other farmers have told me, that's about the only way it could work. And there are a lot of young people that want to start farming, but the opportunity just isn't there.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's Jim Goodman, dairy farmer from Waniwok. He's talking there about why he thinks state policy is favoring the biggest dairy operations, making it difficult for smaller farms to stay in business. First, over the last few years, avocados have gone from popular fruit to superfood. Sports fans turn avocados into guacamole for the big game. The fitness community likes to add them to healthy smoothies, and apparently millennials like to put them on toast. And if you have special ways of working avocados into your cooking or your routine, let us know. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Erin Alderson joins us now for this week's Food Friday. She's a cookbook author, founder of the vegetarian website Naturally Ella, and a big fan of avocados. She even has her own avocado tree. Erin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you have an avocado tree. You're not in Wisconsin. We can't grow our own here, so we have to rely on the grocery store. How do we pick the right, appropriately ripe avocado?
It's all about feel. You want to grab... You hold the avocado and very gently just press on the avocado. And if it gives just a little bit, then you have the perfectly ripe avocado.
And yeah, if it smooshes too far, that's probably too far gone.
Yes. Yes. And if it doesn't give it all, you can still go ahead and buy the avocado and then just let it sit out on the counter for a little bit until it does become ripe.
So you're kind of investing in your future there.
You are, yes. Sometimes you have to plan ahead a little bit.
Now, every now and then in Wisconsin, I'll see different varieties, but usually you see just the one kind of avocado. I think it's the Haas avocado. Do
yes.
you have a favorite kind of avocado if we find a store with a selection?
So it's interesting because Haas is actually, I think, like 90% of the avocados that are grown in California. And so even for me in the state of California, it's kind of hard to find avocados that aren't Haas. But I have a little cato tree, which is actually the variety that I grow. It's a dwarf size and it's one of my favorites. And it's really good tasting and has a smooth texture to it.
And is it a smaller avocado then?
It is. It ranges from like 8 ounces to 10 to 12 ounces per the avocado.
Now let's get into the basics of avocado safety. We've heard stories of avocado hand lately as they get more popular. We're having people cutting their hands by mistake. Can you talk through your best way to cut up that avocado for use in our food?
So I like to put it on the cutting board and still insert the knife parallel to the cutting board and then just rotate the avocado around the pit, because a lot of people will hold it in their hands and do the same thing, and it's so easy to slice your hand that way.
Right, so do not hold the avocado in your hand, and I do catch myself doing that every now and then, but if you keep the avocado on the board, you're okay.
Yes.
Now, I got to ask, you are looking at your website, you work with a lot of foods, you love avocados. What is it you like so much about them?
I mean, for me, being a vegetarian, I'm always looking for foods that are really have those good nutritions. And since avocados are the good, healthy fats, they're just really good to add to my diet because of trying to balance everything out. And plus, they're really versatile. You know, you can obviously put the avocado on toast, but they also work well for sauces and dressings. And one of my favorite desserts is actually an chocolate avocado pudding.
Chocolate avocado pudding. Tell me more about that. I didn't see that on the website.
I don't have a recipe for it because there's a place here where I live in Sacramento that does an amazing vegan version. And they use the avocado for the smoothness and the thickness of what you kind of would use the cream for in a traditional pudding, and instead use the avocado.
We're talking to Erin Alderson, cookbook author. You can check out her website, Naturally Ella. And we are talking about avocados, cooking with avocados. And I should put cooking in quotes, Erin, because you say, for the most part, you like an uncooked avocado. They're great raw.
Yes. You know, I see a lot of people grilling avocados or breading and frying avocados. I've even seen on restaurant menus where people are deep frying avocado slices. And I'm just not a fan. You can do it, but I really love the taste of the raw avocado.
Now, I love avocados on sandwiches or burgers or whatever. What's up with this avocado toast apparently trend? This is a big thing in restaurants, and there are Australian multimillionaires saying millennials aren't able to save money because they keep buying expensive avocado toast. But what is the appeal of avocado toast these days?
You know, I think it's the good fat coming from the avocado. It's just a really healthy topping for toast. And I mean, who doesn't love, I mean, there's so many ways to prepare avocados and outside of guacamole. And I think it's just such a great way to showcase the avocado. And it doesn't have to be expensive if you make it from home.
I want to check out, you gave us a few recipes, and I want to get into one of those now. A sandwich we'll start with, the avocado mozzarella and jalapeno chimichurri grilled cheese recipe. Again, linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, so that's I'm always out to try and do different kinds of grilled cheese sandwiches. And the chimichurri has really a lot of fresh herbs in it, and it pairs well with the melty cheese and the fresh avocado.
What goes into the chimichurri?
Parsley and cilantro are the main, and then a little bit of shallot and vinegar just to kind of bring out the acidity a little bit.
And some jalapeno, just what, diced up?
Yeah, I usually mince the jalapeno. Sometimes I make the chimichurri with the jalapeno or without. My husband's not a big fan of heat, and so sometimes I have to leave it out.
And talk about just using avocado in any old sandwich, between bread in any way, shape, or form.
It's great. Just sliced up. You can also mash it a little bit and use it as a spread. Sometimes I'll do a mash with just a little bit of lemon juice and salt. Again, kind of balancing the acidity with the creaminess of the avocado makes a really good spread for especially veggie sandwiches. I love to layer sandwiches with sliced carrot and spinach and peppers and tomatoes, and that avocado can kind of bring everything together.
I don't have numbers to back this up, but I would guess the majority of avocados in the United States are eaten in guacamole form. Could you talk about what makes a good guac?
Oh, gosh. I think it's definitely a personal preference, but I like to keep mine simple with just a little bit of lime juice, salt, cilantro, minced onion, a little bit of garlic, and that's pretty much it. I saw recently where someone was adding peas. I think it might have been the New York Times added peas to their guacamole, and it was an outrage on social media.
This is an internet outrage, you're right.
Yeah. Yes, internet outrage about adding peas to guacamole. So I like to keep mine simple, no big fuss over it.
Now here's a controversy over guacamole. Yeah, there's more than one controversy over guacamole. My wife is the guac maker in our house. She uses sour cream. I love it. I've run into people who view that almost as like a form of heresy. But what's your opinion on sour cream and guacamole?
You know, I mean, being a vegetarian recipe developer, I also make a lot of vegan recipes. Mm-hmm. And so I tend not to add dairy unless I have to. And so, again, I'm a purist. I like my guacamole pretty simple. So sour cream is probably a big no for me.
but you won't mock others for doing it.
I won't.
I
no.
Okay.
You know, no. Oh,
not on the air anyway.
No.
Let's get into another one. Now, we mentioned mostly raw, but here's a baked avocado tostadas recipe. Again, this one's linked on our Central Time Facebook page. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah. So I love, I love the idea of tacos for breakfast, and the tostada is kind of the open-faced version of that, where the tortilla is off really crisp. And for that recipe, I layered avocado on top and baked the egg in between. The avocado kind of holds the egg in. It's a perfect base for adding hot sauce and salsa, and it's just a really refreshing breakfast.
And you could play with that in a lot of different ways, a little cilantro, or you could spice that in a lot of different ways, couldn't you?
Yes. Oh, yeah, definitely.
So do you experiment? I mean, on your website, you've got a lot of different avocado recipes. Do you do a lot of experimenting with avocados?
I do. I mean, I'm really lucky to live in the California Valley, where it's so easy to get fresh avocados. And it's actually, we're right in avocado season right now. June is peak avocado season in California. And so it's really easy to find those fresh avocados. And so I just love having them on hand. And I have a toddler, and avocados are one of those foods that's just super easy to feed him. And I know he's getting something healthy and delicious. And so, yeah, always on hand this time of year.
Yeah, that reminds me, my kids, when they were toddlers, it was an easy food for them. They'd eat cubed up avocado, and then they turned on it at some point and won't touch it. So I don't know. Do you think you have a good older, say, teen or older kid friendly avocado recipe that could get them back in the game?
Maybe. I love burrito bowls. Again, it kind of goes back to guacamole aspect of things. Burrito bowls, or I have a really awesome black bean burrito where I put rice and guacamole inside the burrito, kind of like a Chipotle thing. But you can do it at home, and it's super simple.
We're talking to Erin Alderson, cookbook author, founder of the vegetarian cooking website, naturallyella.com. She's talking to us about cooking with avocados. You can see some of her recipe ideas linked on our Facebook page. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tell us how you like to use avocados in your cooking and or your eating. Do you have a guacamole secret or an avocado toast recipe that you'd like to share? Do you eat it for health benefits or just because you like it? And if you have questions about using avocados, Erin may have an answer for you. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation now with Erin Alderson, founder of the vegetarian cooking website, naturallyella.com. We're looking at how you can cook with avocados this summer, and you can get some recipe ideas on the Central Time Facebook page. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you an avocado fan or fanatic? How do you use it in your foods, maybe your smoothies? If you have suggestions, we'd love to hear them. If you have questions, Erin might be able to help you out. Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post and find some recipes on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Gail is on the line in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Oh, I'm going to share my summer avocado soup recipe, which is just throwing it all in the blender, the avocados with yogurt and fresh lime squeezed in there with cayenne pepper, salt and pepper. And then you do a little chopped tomato on top, but you throw it in the blender and you just whip it up, and it's like an oxygen rush to your brain.
Wow.
When you eat it. Oh, it's amazing. Well, that's what avocados do. They give your brain oxygen. And you can, the first time I made it, people were eating and going, oh my God, my head just, it just goes right to your head.
It's a mind-altering substance.
Oh, I make it thick, so it's almost like a pudding. It's just so good.
And Gail, this is served, a dish best served cold, right?
Oh, yes. What better in summer than something creamy, wonderful, and cold and fresh?
And I wanted to make sure the tomato doesn't go in the blender. It's sprinkled on top afterward, right?
It's sprinkled on top, little dices, and yeah, and it's on top. Yeah,
and
then you've got the cayenne pepper in there to your taste of how spicy you like it.
Is there a little onion in the game, too?
A little bit of onion in the game, too, yeah.
All right, Gail, that sounds fantastic. Erin, what do you think?
I think it sounds wonderful. I do something similar, and then I like to add a little cucumber into the soup as well.
Cucumber, oh, that would be good. Now, how would you do that if you wanted to do it without the dairy, Erin?
So I'm really big into using cashew creams and almond creams, which are essentially, you know, just pureed almonds with a little bit of water, pureed cashews with a little bit of water. And so you can kind of get that creaminess from the nuts, and that also adds some good fat into the soup as well.
Gail, thanks so much for sharing that. Sounds like great food for some hot summer days like we've had lately. Before we go back to our callers, Aaron, avocados in smoothies, a lot of people use them. And does that give it that touch of creaminess, again, if you're not using the yogurt in there?
Yes. And so, you know, it's kind of interesting because you would be worried about the flavor being too much, but the avocado just blends in really nicely and you don't really, it's not an overly impactful taste, and it does, it really adds that smooth and creaminess to it.
Gail, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Charlene in La Crosse. Charlene, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Charlene?
I have a question about avocados that are really, really ripe or possibly even overripe. I've noticed sometimes that when I cut them open, they have like almost like little dark spidery veins. I guess I'll describe it as like fibers. What is that, or is it good to, should I just throw it out when it gets to that point? Or is there any harm in accidentally mixing that in like a guacamole?
What do you think, Aaron?
You know, so I don't really know what's behind it. I've never researched. That's a good question, but I know exactly what you're talking about. And I usually just try and either cut around it, or if it's not too bad, I'll go ahead and use it. When the avocado gets to the point of where you have actual brown spots, that's usually when I'll start to question whether or not I want to use it, because the flavor tends to change when it gets a little overly ripe.
Hope that helps, Charlene. And I wanted to ask Aaron, you know, sometimes I'll cut open an avocado to put some on whatever sandwich, and I want to keep the rest. The way I do it is I put it in the fridge, I keep both peels, I keep the pit, and kind of put it all back together. That seems to keep it pretty well for me in the fridge. Any other ideas on how to keep that avocado from turning brown once you've started using it?
You know, it's amazing. You can go down a rabbit hole of researching this, and I've done it numerous times. There are many opinions about how to keep an avocado ripe once you cut it open. But a couple that I've seen work pretty well is, one is wrapping it in plastic wrap. But I try to not use a lot of plastic. And so the other, and this trick's going to sound a little weird, but you put it in an airtight container with a little bit of onion, and the onion actually helps keep the avocado green.
Interesting. Well, thanks a lot for the call, Charlene. We're talking to Aaron Alderson about cooking with avocados. Her website is naturallyella.com. We've got some of her recipes linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234, your avocado-related calls. Jay is with us in Racine. Jay, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I have an awesome recipe. And I don't know if you know about this, but if you take a slightly unripe avocado and you slice it into pieces, kind of like French fries, and you marinate them in soy sauce and then beer batter them and deep fry them, they're insanely good, like insane. And if you want to get adventurous, add a little bit panko too. The Japanese breadcrumbs, and oh my God.
Jay, do you put that out with your fish fry?
You could put it out with anything. It's just absolutely amazing. But the secret to it is you have to use slightly unripe avocados. You know, when you get them and they're just a little too hard, that's what you want.
Because are they going to fall apart if they're too ripe?
Yeah, if you try to use like delicious ripe avocados, they just don't hold together. But the slightly unripe ones, like where they're just not quite there, that's the ones you want to use for that.
Sounds fantastic, Jay. Aaron, have you played with frying or deep frying, batter frying avocado?
I've pan fried them before. I've never deep fried them. I've seen a lot of deep fried avocados on menus recently, and so it's definitely something I've tried, but I've never tried to make it.
All right.
But they sound delicious.
Jay, thanks a lot for the suggestion. Phil joins us next in Algoma. Phil, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about? I'm good. What do you got for avocado land, Phil?
Well, we've got a recipe. We use it as a side salad sometimes, or just eat it for breakfast. We cut an avocado in half and throw the pit away, and add chopped onions, salt and pepper, chopped tiny tomatoes, bacon bits, and a little bit of Italian dressing.
And do you layer that, or do you stir it all together?
Stir it all together in where the pit was.
Okay, and you still serve it in the peel. You use it as a salad bowl.
Well, sometimes we serve it in the peel most of the time, but once in a while we'll take it out of the peel. It's a little easier to eat that way, but using the peel as a bowl works better for us, actually.
That sounds great, Phil. Thanks for that call. And Aaron, that reminds me, you gave us an avocado salad recipe. This one is avocado salad with chickpeas. Again, we have this on our Central Time Facebook page. Tell us about that one.
It's actually one of my favorite avocado salads. It has chickpeas, brown rice, a little bit of lettuce, and a lemon dressing. It's really easy to throw together, and the flavors all work well together, and it's one of my favorite lunches during the summer months.
And is the avocado cubed up, or is it kind of all mushed in with all the other stuff?
For that, I like to leave the avocado cubed up, tend to be on a little bit more of the unripe side. Avocados are one of those things that you want to hit it just right. And so I always wait for when I can just get that nice squeeze on the avocado, and then that's when I know I want to use it for a salad like that.
That reminds me, I've tried something. We had a Food Friday guest on a while back who did Cuban American cooking, and I used a recipe for an avocado salad, but then diced up, I used frozen pineapple and mango mixed in with that and a little bit of spices. Avocado seems to pair pretty well with a lot of kinds of fruit, I guess especially tropical fruit.
Yeah, I've seen people add mango to their guacamole as well. I think the creaminess of the avocado, because avocados aren't huge flavor, and so they do pair really well with the sweetness of fruit. I've seen avocado and strawberry salads before, which are delicious.
Now, avocado, it's an example of something you do on the website. You don't just throw up random recipes there. You actually like to really dig deep into one ingredient or component of recipes. Why do you approach cooking that way?
It's seasonal based for me. I love using what's in season, and it's really, especially being a vegetarian, it's fun to highlight the different produce or different grains and legumes that I might use to kind of get people inspired to use those different ingredients.
I think it was on your website I saw that avocados aren't as seasonal anymore because now we're getting them from all over the world. Do you appreciate that in some ways, or regret it that it isn't as seasonal? We can get them all the time, so it's not as special.
You know, it's interesting. I grew up in Illinois. I lived in Illinois until I was well into my 20s. And so avocados were never in season for me. And so moving to California, it's been interesting to kind of learn about the seasonal aspect of it. And it makes me appreciate more avocados grown in California versus grown around the world.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town, Michigan. I don't think I could have picked an avocado out of a lineup if you asked me to until I was well into my 20s, I think. But are you glad that they are out there and accessible to more people now?
I am, because there's just such a nutritious addition to meals, and they're really easy to work with because they're beautiful fresh. It's easy to get excited about avocados.
So what is your next avocado dish or experiment you have in the works?
A taco with a black bean taco with an avocado sweet corn relish.
Avocado sweet corn relish. That sounds fantastic.
Yes.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it. It's been fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Aaron Alderson. She's a cookbook author. She's the founder of the vegetarian cooking website, NaturallyElla.com. She was with us to talk about cooking with avocados, and she shared some recipe ideas. We've got three of her recipes, by the way. You can find them either on the Central Time part of WPR.org or head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Three different recipes: that salad we were just talking about with chickpeas, baked avocado and tostadas, and what was the other? Oh, yeah, avocado, mozzarella, and jalapeno chimichurri grilled cheese recipe. And you can share your favorites and your tips and suggestions while you're there. That's all on the Central Time Facebook page. If you've been looking for a way to celebrate Canada's 150th birthday, and I know you are, and you have trouble finding your money, our neighbors to the north have you covered. Canada is releasing new $2 coins that glow in the dark. One side of the coin, here's the deal, it shows a canoe on a lake and a person in the canoe, and there's like woods, and then there's the northern lights in the background, and the lights actually shine in the dark on this coin. The design came from a contest to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the Confederation of the Canadian Colonies into the Dominion of Canada. The new coin will be called a toonie, as in a $2 coin, toonie, and that goes along with the famous loonie, the $1 coin with an image of a loon on it. So clearly, our Canadian neighbors know how to celebrate a birthday, the 150th in this case, and they're hoping, in part, it's a way to celebrate, and they're hoping that this will make them more competitive on the international coin collecting market. Pretty unique, having this glow-in-the-dark coin. We'll give the final word to some of Canada's most famous exports, Geddy Lee of the band Rush, and Bob and Doug McKenzie. This is Central Time.
Drum solo. Okay, everyone, like, this is me on the drums. Oh, eh? Yeah.